Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Listnick Behind the Curtain. It's our chance each weekend to catch up with a show that's in town, a Broadway in Chicago, or one of the other great shows that's playing around here. But as you know, from time to time, I take a break from that to talk about something really related and really cool. And now we're going to be talking about a brand new book that is out. It's called Broadway Nation. It's by David Armstrong, who is my guest today for this show. I'm going to pause and say, David, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Paul. So great to be here. I can't wait to talk about my book and have everybody in Chicago and elsewhere hear about it.
Yeah, because the book itself is an encyclopedia of Broadway. I'm just kind of how thick this thing is. And look, I know a little bit about Broadway, and I got to tell you, I would test from time to time. I would sort of think of a show that maybe you missed, you know, something that ran for a real show. And I'd look it up and go, oh, he didn't get this one. Darn if it wasn't in there. So you pretty much got everything. We'll talk about all of that history as we go through. You yourself, by the way, are a professor at University of Washington, where you teach drama. You've been everything from a choreographer to a director and a producer. You do a very popular podcast called Broadway Nation, which people can check out. So there's a lot of places to learn, but now we're going to learn from your book. And I want to start here because the book is not just a history of Broadway. It is that. But it actually had me asking a question I've never asked myself before, which is, what did we have before Broadway? I mean, it's kind of like Broadway's always been here, but what was here before there was a Broadway, and how did Broadway get started? Because you answer that in the book.
Well, and that's the opening of the book is to, and I have the same question. And especially, you know, people would say to me, I talk about the Broadway musical being America's great invented art form. It's great, you know, only in America art form. People say, well, there's been musical theater forever, and that's absolutely true. And so I sort of talk through that at the beginning of the book, how since the beginning of time, really, people have created some form of musical theater. Every culture in the world has created its own version of musical theater. And the Broadway musical is arguably the most recent incarnation of that, what I think is sort of a basic human form. People seem to be really interested. I found that quote, I think it's really on the first page practically. In 2022, researchers discovered that we have a neuron in our brain that only activates when to singing, not to instrumental music or to speaking. And to me, that makes it so clear that the musical theater, this art form is part in our DNA. We have to have this. We must see it as human beings.
Yeah, and now people can go to the book to find out how so much started with the ballet opera, European opera. You take us into the 1700s with the Park Theater, just all this stuff. And I believe the first show that opens on Broadway called The Black Crook, September 12th, 1866. But even that was a French ballet company. I mean, it wasn't Oklahoma opening on Broadway in 1866.
We would not recognize that as a musical, as far as I'm concerned. And I actually don't credit it as the first musical, although many other historians do. And I think, and I understand why, because it's the first giant hit show. It's a giant hit. It's certainly a landmark in show business history, but I wouldn't say it's a Broadway musical.
Fair enough. But I just love being able to address that question going, yeah, I never thought about that. Now, Here's the thing. I want to clarify something about the book because you detail. Yeah, somebody can just read it to read a history of Broadway. There is probably a key reason somebody would want to read it and go through it. But there's other ways to work with this book if you are either a researcher or you just have a specific interest. Maybe you are interested in studying the African-Americans in history, LGBTQ plus community in history, women in the history of Broadway. So there is a way of going through the book. You kind of code everything. So if your focus is something in particular, you can use the book that way, too.
That was one of the great contributions of my editor, Dom O'Hanlon at Bloomsbury, Methuen Drama, which is an imprint of Bloomsbury Publishing. And he suggested, because the subtitle of the book is How Immigrant Jewish, Queer, and Black Artists Invented the Broadway Musical, his idea was, could we create some kind of way that if you were interested primarily in the immigrant story, you could go through the book just reading that thread or the, as you said, for the Black creators, the women creators, all the way through, you can go through the Jewish creators. You could read straight through the book just through that lens to begin with, if you want to, or go back later and say, I knew there was something in there about about that subject and find it very easily. And people have seemed to be responding to that.
It's a great research tool, as I said, for anybody that just wants to study or has a question about some component. And then I thought of another interesting sort of question your book triggers for me early on, which is, again, something you never ask yourself, but what makes something a Broadway musical? Now, part of it is you're on Broadway. But what I mean by that question is you address it, is why did Broadway become the focus? I mean, why wasn't, Times Square? I mean, we look at that now, but it could have been anywhere. Could it? Why wasn't it in Seattle, Washington? And why did it happen as we know it in Times Square and on Broadway?
And what is so interesting about that, and you're right, it's the heart of the book, is it's not a coincidence, I would say, but it's only because of all these various factors coming together, both in terms of the birth of show business at that time, but also these waves of immigration that were happening to New York. There would be no Broadway musical if it wasn't for these waves of open immigration at the turn of the century. There also would be no Broadway musical as we know it if it wasn't for the great migration, they call it, where thousands, millions of Blacks moved from the South to the North, especially to New York City. So those kind of, historical, seem not very sexy events. They're just, historical kinds of demographic events are really at the core of why this happens. And it's because those things come together. And most significantly, in some ways, is because we have all these marginalized groups arriving in New York City at the same time with very little opportunity to do anything else. And show business is formed, is born at that moment, again, because of just population. The size of the population needs to be entertained. And frankly, the respectable people won't be in it, won't do it. It's not something respectable people will do. So it creates this opportunity for people who can't be so picky about what they do to get out of, the jobs that they were regulated to, just and move into something where they could really make an impact.
And I want to now tap just for a moment into each of these groups that you look at. Let me start with the immigrant group, noting that truly so many of them were Jewish who immigrated here. And, you talk about George M. Cohan, Irving Berlin, Hammerstein, Ziegfeld, the Schuberts. Is there something, what is it about being an immigrant? I mean, you kind of touched on that, but what is it about being an immigrant and a Jewish immigrant that sent you? Look, if you would have said to me, what did many immigrants do when they came here? I mean, my grandparents were immigrants who came here. Well, they became tailors. They worked the meat market. That's what they did. But these folks produced Broadway musicals.
Again, part of it is because they came from cultures that had rich musical and theatrical traditions. So they're able to draw on that. Many of the Jewish inventors of Broadway, from George M. Cohan, from Irving Berlin to Al Jolson, their fathers or their grandfathers had been cantors. So they had this music in their world. And just to clarify, George M. Cohan, of course, is Irish. But the Irish immigrant story is crucial as well, because at that time, the Irish were at the bottom of the pecking order, especially Irish Catholics were as low as you could go in the social hierarchy. And again, they needed to, and they had this rich theatrical and language culture that they came from, even if they were very undereducated the way most of them were. George M. Cohan, Irving Berlin, most of them didn't even graduate from grade school. And Berlin is one of the great stories of American history. He arrives as a 9-year-old boy, speaking nothing but Yiddish, maybe a little Russian, and never goes past the sixth grade, probably, maybe the third grade, we don't really know, is on the streets dancing as a newsie, like in Newsies. That's Irving Berlin. And he ends up inventing American culture. Just to give three examples, he writes God Bless America, White Christmas, and Easter Parade. And I find that to be an unbelievable story.
And what's also unbelievable, well, it's believable once you think about it, but you talk about the forgotten forefathers, or let's say foremothers of Broadway. And when you're there, you're really talking about Black artists, the minstrel shows. It was the end of an era. But basically, you talk about the fact that because of discrimination, we didn't have a lot of Black musicals.
Right. Although that was the big discovery for me. I thought I knew everything about the Broadway musical, and I mean that literally, but I knew a lot. And what I didn't know, and most books won't tell you, is that many books will tell you that Shuffle Along is the first Black musical on Broadway written by, directed by, starring Black artists and the big hit. And indeed, it was a giant hit and it was a game changer. But there were 20 shows on Broadway prior to that between 1890 and 1910 that we never talk about, that nobody really ever, it's not that they're hidden, but they are not in the books. They're completely sort of ignored most of the time. What we also don't talk about is that Shuffle Along wasn't a one-off. There were then 20 more Black Broadway musicals that came after it, all through the 20s and into the 30s until the Depression sort of put the kibosh on everything.
And another group you talk about, which I think we should mention before we take a break, but is to say, to a great degree, the Broadway musical is really a queer creation. I mean, it doesn't exist without the LGBTQ plus community, and yet for decades and decades, so many had to hide who they were.
It was they did, and of course, because the world we live in and the world we can look back in time. But what's so fascinating is to see how open they were able to be within the world of the theater, and how early this starts. This starts right from the beginning, from 1900 and before. We have queer artists, gay men, most of them, but also some lesbians who are very instrumental in the creation of the Broadway musical, and they are in positions of power right from the beginning, which I find really interesting. This is one field of business, probably maybe the only field of business, that they can be in control of. They can be in charge of everything, as well as all through the ranks of the Broadway musical. But they're producers, they're directors, they're writers, and they're involved in literally in almost every show in the entire history of the Broadway musical.
And we're going to walk now through the sort of periods of time of the Broadway history. There's the Silver Age. I wish I'd gotten to the point of intermission because we're going to take a break. We're just shy of intermission in your book, but we're going to talk about that. But during this commercial break, David, this will be a good time where I'm going to have a little cup of coffee out of my behind the curtain mug. You too will have one. But for now, we're going to take a break and be right back. Stay with us. And welcome back to Paul Lisnett Behind the Curtain. We're taking an in-depth look at the book Broadway Nation. We talk a lot about Broadway on this show and the various shows, but this book, brand new, is truly a complete and thorough history of everything Broadway you would want to know. David Armstrong, professor at University of Washington and a producer, choreographer, director, all sorts of things, is with me, but he's the author of this book, which is why he is with me. David, let's walk through the various, you kind of divide things up into the ages of the development of Broadway musicals. And things start in the Silver Age, of which you have a part one and part two to it. Let's just take them together. We go between that area of the end of World War I and the opening of Oklahoma. We'll start with history and go to the show Oklahoma in 1943. Yeah. 300 musicals during the 20th. Tell me about the Silver Age.
So the Silver Age of Broadway is one of the tasks I had to do was name these eras, number one, because surprisingly, among theater historians, there's almost no agreement. Everyone will talk about the Golden Age of Broadway, but almost nobody agrees on when that started and when it ended and if it ever happened at all. So I felt in order to teach it to begin with and then to write about it, I had to define things. So I've divided the history of Broadway, this sort of 125-year history, more or less, into five eras. The Genesis era, which we just talked about, where the Broadway musical is being created and invented. Then the Silver Age of Broadway, which is basically the 1920s and the 1930s up to the opening night of Oklahoma. And then the Golden Age goes from the opening night of Oklahoma to the opening night of Hair.
And I'm going to stop you there because we're going to talk about the Golden Age.
Okay, great. We'll get there.
Why is Oklahoma a stopping point?
Because I always look for the turning points when the form of the musical changed. And the Silver Age, really, I probably should say that it starts with Shuffle Along because jazz music comes to Broadway with Shuffle Along. And then within a a year, with the 6 months practically, jazz becomes synonymous with the Broadway musical, with the Gershwin shows, with all that kind of stuff. So that's a big change. But those shows in the 1920s and 30s are mostly musical comedies, and they're very loosey-goosey. It's why there's 300 shows, as you just said, from that period, and almost none of them, maybe three, are ever produced today. Anything Goes being really the only one we see on a regular basis. And that's because they weren't interested in the stories. They were interested in the stars, and they were interested in the songs.
And of course, the Depression hit. So we'll skip that on this conversation. People need to read the book, but that talks about obviously the problems that the Depression created for people. And one of the reasons people wanted lighter fare on the stage, because they were depressed anywhere else that they were with what was going on. So you take us into, well, what you call the intermission in the book, but really into the golden age. And now for people who are maybe younger who are watching us, they want to hear about people like Sondheim and Lin-Manuel Miranda. And yes, we take us all the way through all of them in this book. But let us go back to Hammerstein, if we can, or Rodgers and Hammerstein, because there is a different sense. When I think of those kinds of musicals, when they began to write them in the 50s, 40s, and all of that, there is a difference. You could almost tell they're musicals, and it's very different from what starts to happen maybe when Sondheim enters the picture in 1960-ish with West Side Story.
So to answer your question from a moment ago, what's different about the Golden Age is the focus shifts to the story. And Rodgers and Hammerstein largely drive that shift. They decide that the most important thing in a musical is now going to be the story. And all the elements have to contribute to telling that story. And you can't do what you used to do in the Silver Age, which is just stick in any song or just have the star do their comedy routine in the middle of something. It needs to be driven by the storytelling elements. And then, and of course, they're not the only ones to do it. There's Lerner and Lowe and Comden and Green and so many people involved in that, in the golden age of Broadway. There's
Jerry Herman, by the way, to toss him.
Jerry Herman, absolutely. And Sondheim and Hal Prince are integral to that as well with West Side Story and Gypsy. And for me, then the next shift comes with the opening night of Hair. But right on the heels of Hair are the concept musicals of Sondheim and Prince. It's this whole effort to reinvent the musical. And some of it is generational, like anything else. People want to do something different than the generation before them did. And in this case, they go back to the Silver Age in many ways and bring back some of the elements of the revue and things that happened back then. And they felt very new, and they were also sort of, well, they were the opposite of the musical play, of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical play. They wanted to do something that was, you know, in form very different. So that's what kicks off for me the modern era of Broadway, which we're still in to a great extent. I sort of divide it with the beginning of the 21st century, but we're still in this modern era today.
And you call that Act Four in the book, the modern era. Just a name to toss in. We've been talking about these, you know, first of all, Sondheim. And I know you are a friend, as I am, with Richard Schuck, who wrote the book on Sondheim. People can go back, and he was with me just a few weeks ago on this show, so you can get a lot of a big dose of Sondheim there. But when you talk about Hair in the 1970s, bringing in the change, you also mentioned Pippin, and that's Stephen Schwartz. And so, just as a thing, to me, I mean, I love Stephen Schwartz. I've interviewed him a few times. Wicked, please. Okay, we get it. But the thing is, when you think of an impact that Sondheim had on the shaping of the Broadway musical, maybe versus a Stephen Schwartz, I mean, Sondheim kind of has a bigger impact, doesn't he?
That's debatable. A big question. What's going to be the biggest movie of this year? Wicked. So what's the biggest thing happening in our culture? So I think that they're sort of neck and neck there in many ways. In terms of the...
But I'm sticking to Broadway now. I'm not going to give them the credit for the movie yet.
I understand that, but it is a Broadway musical that's been turned into a movie. Yeah. And I think that if we're talking about the impact on the creators of today, on the people writing musicals today, I would think it's like 50% Sondheim and 50% Stephen Schwartz. That if you look at Ben Pasek and Justin Paul, I think they would probably say that to you, the people who wrote Dear Evan Hansen and are writing so many other things now. They are equally influenced by those two things.
Fair enough. They're both so incredible. And we can't ignore the British invasion. And I'm so glad you have a section of the book about that. And I assume most of the watchers of this show know, but when you're talking about Phantom of the Opera, Les Miserables, Miss Saigon, it's a new, I mean, all of those, and now you're in the Andrew Lloyd Webber world and the Tim Rice, but to me, I always look at those and say they're almost like a new kind of opera. The British invasion brings us a new form of opera, right or wrong?
Well, no, very close, because I actually say they bring the operetta back to Broadway. So the operetta was a staple of the Silver Age and sort of disappeared in the Golden Age, because in many ways, what Rodgers and Hammerstein did was merge the musical comedy and the operetta together to make a musical play. But operettas fell out of fashion, fell out of style. But it's literally what Andrew Lloyd Webber and the Cameron McIntosh shows that were produced at Cameron McIntosh that you just talked about are basically modern operettas and are almost indistinguishable in many ways from Rosemarie or Naughty Marietta or some of the great operettas of the past, which they have the exact same values. They use, you know, very legitimate singing. They're trying to showcase great classical style voices, and they're telling often very dramatic stories set in the past. They're operettas. And so, yes, I agree with you completely.
The difference between an opera and an operetta is?
Operettas are more like musicals in that they usually have spoken dialogue in them. Yeah. They will be long sections or short and long sections of spoken dialogue, and then it will break into song. Whereas operas, and you know, there's no hard and fast rules here, mostly are sung completely through from the beginning to end. And then some of those, but then you'd say, well, what about Andrew Lloyd Webber? He does sung through shows like Evita as well. Yes, it's you can't really define it exactly. The opera Carmen has a lot of dialogue in it. And spoken dialogue. So there are varieties along the way. But I think that's the main reason, is the focus of an operetta is more like a musical in most ways.
And plus, people who don't like operas get to pretend they're sophisticated because they do like this new genre of musical.
I think that's absolutely right.
You then get into the world. Well, I was going to talk about 1900s and 2000, but let's talk about Disney for a moment, because a lot of folks watching us, maybe they have kids, whatever, but Disney, man, 1994, Beauty and the Beast, which just played here in the 25th anniversary tour around, back here in Chicago. What is about Disney that he knows how to tap into, or that the company knows how to tap into?
Well, what happened with that, and I tell this story in there, is that the creators of Little Shop of Horrors, Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, who were immersed in the history of Broadway and in the style of Broadway. They loved everything about the Broadway musical. And with Little Shop of Horrors, which of course was a giant off-Broadway hit back in the day, they wrote, in my mind, one of the most perfect musicals you could possibly write, a modern musical comedy that works on all fronts. So then Disney hired them to come and help them reinvent their musical films. And what Howard Ashman especially brought to Disney was this, the way you do a Broadway musical. So he basically wrote Broadway musicals to be animated musicals. So, and that really hadn't happened before with their animated movies. Even if you go back to Snow White, actually is an exception to that. But most of them were just movies with songs, as opposed to written in that sort of musical play style. And so it wasn't so much that Disney discovered a way to do it, except they were really smart to hire Howard Ashman to come and help them reinvent it. So, of course, then those shows were already Broadway musicals on film. And then the idea of bringing them to Broadway, sort of back to Broadway in a way, was an obvious one.
Well, David, we still have to talk about Lin-Manuel Miranda, and we still have to talk about why it is that not every movie or play works as a musical. There must be something to it. You write all about it. So people who are watching us, every question I'm asking is answered tenfold in the book, and a lot more we didn't have time for, but I'm not ready to let you go. We want to do a little bit more of a chat so that people on Monday morning can tune in to the WGNradio.com podcast version of this show. Can you hang with me and talk a little bit more?
I can stay all night and sing them all.
I love it. We're going to do that. The book is Broadway Nation. You want to pick up a copy immediately and have your cup of coffee while you're doing so in the Behind the Curtain mug, which you can get at WGNTV.com/store. David Armstrong is my guest. Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you all for watching us here on Behind the Curtain. We'll see you next week and check this show out with a bonus content on Monday morning. Take care, everybody. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Paul Listen Behind the Curtain. This is our bonus conversation. Hopefully you watched the show on WGN Plus over the weekend where we had the conversation you've just watched, but you're with us now, which means you're on WGNradio.com or YouTube or one of the many podcast sites, Spotify, that this show appears. And it allows me to have a continued conversation with my guests. You've seen that from week to week as we have some spectacular people, as we do today. David Armstrong, the author of Broadway Nation, a complete history of Broadway that allows you to study and research, and it's written in just such a really readable way that I love. I really couldn't put it down, David. I just found myself every night kind of picking it up, reading more and reading more. So I want to pick up where we left off on the TV stream and talk more about really the later works and where we are. But one of the things I said at the end is that not every movie or whatever works, and we've seen efforts of that. People have tried to, you know, take a movie, turn it into a musical. What is it that makes a musical work that might help us understand why something doesn't work?
And of course, the mediums are very different between a Broadway musical and a film musical. And of course, there are film musicals that were never on Broadway that are just original film musicals. But what's interesting is that most of those are more, how do I say this? They're movies first and musical second. And Broadway musicals are musicals first, which means that they are using the, I define a Broadway musical at the beginning of the book, and I say it's where the music and lyrics are the most important element in the storytelling. And that scares filmmakers a lot. They are very afraid of that idea, and they sort of shy away. If I haven't seen the new Kiss of the Spider-Woman movie, but that's a good example. They have taken out all the songs that happened in real life. Now, that can work very well. The movie of Cabaret is one of the greatest movies of all time. And Bob Fosse did that same thing. He took out the book songs. But it's an instinct that people get afraid of. And then I think when the greatest movie musicals, and however you feel about The Sound of Music, that movie works like gangbusters. You might think it's too treacly or any of the things that have been criticized about it, but you immediately accept that they're going to sing and dance in this story, and that that is the language of the story. And I've always been puzzled why people, of course, you know, people say, well, we don't sing and dance in real life. Well, we also don't, you know, there aren't superheroes in real life or vampires or anybody, any of these other things that people accept so readily.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I answered you. Go ahead.
Well, you'll have moments of, and I'm lifting up what you're right, in Singing in the Rain, most of us don't wait for it to rain and start dancing up and down light posts and everything else as Gene Kelly did. But then take one of my all-time favorite musicals, which is Fiddler on the Roof. And yes, the singing is there, the dancing is there, but yet it is part of the story. In fact, I don't think it ever, you have a moment in a movie like Fiddler where you step out and say, I've left this movie, I'm listening to a song now, because it just, the song takes you from the dialogue.
Totally. The goal of the filmmaker, the job of the filmmaker then is to create a world in which we readily accept that people are going to sing and dance. And I thought Lin-Manuel Miranda actually did that very well in Tick, Tick, Boom, which he directed. And it was interesting to see that back to back with the movie of In the Heights, where I thought, and I don't remember who directed that, but they didn't quite succeed as well. They were a little afraid of it, and they made it all sort of through the eyes of somebody imagining this was going to be similar in a way to the movie of Chicago. Yeah. So it's a theatrical technique that I think can work and has worked brilliantly on film, but people seem to be afraid of it.
Wasn't In the Heights directed by John Chu?
It was. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Got to make sure our show is complete here. Exactly. But here's another. Let me go to Lin-Manuel Miranda again, as you mentioned him, because first of all, well, it's a two-part question. Part one, he is the latest version of somebody who changes the look of a Broadway musical, right? Because now you go to a show, and if there's rap or hip-hop or anything else, you're going, that's Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Right. That's absolutely right. Although he wasn't the first person to put rap on Broadway. But what he was able to do, which is, I think, what all the great creators of the Broadway musical, the great composers and lyricists, been able to do, is meld the contemporary music of the time into telling the story. And so it feels he's doing exactly what Rodgers and Hammerstein laid out said we're supposed to do, which is make the music serve the story. And that's why that show is so great and why it works. It's almost sort of a textbook version. And part of it is because Lin-Manuel Miranda knows the history of the Broadway musical backwards and forwards. He's in love with it. His favorite show is Fiddler on the Roof. He is immersed in that world. And he's just then using the tools and using things. It's a very traditional Broadway musical in many ways, although some people say that it's, you know, a revolution. And it's only a revolution because it had such impact.
One of the things he also did, and I wanted to ask you, this is part two of the question, which is when we talk about movies that are then taken to the Broadway stage or vice versa, whatever, making a movie out of a Broadway show. But Miranda does something different. He just films Hamilton with the original cast, 9-camera shoot. And then you remember, of course, it came out during COVID where he chose to release it, I think, a year early because nobody was going anywhere. Right. And we got to watch it on Disney Plus at the time. But what was your reaction? Is that also going to be, I mean, he's not the first person to do it. They've done it with Next to Normal. They've done it with other shows. PBS does that a fair amount. What is your attitude about let's take the Broadway show, add a whole bunch of cameras, and now it's going to be a movie?
I mean, I think every Broadway show of note should have a video capture of it. It's the economics of that prevent that from happening at times.
Isn't it cheaper than turning it, making a movie of that?
It's certainly cheaper than making a movie of it, whether you get back on the end, whether you can earn income to the level that you would for a movie. I don't know. That's not my world. But I think it's so important from a historian point of view and from the audience point of view. So many people grew up on those great video captures of Into the Woods and Sunday in the Park with George. All the Sondheim shows, he was one of the people that PBS early on decided we're going to document each of his shows. Passion even has a video capture. And those are thrilling. And we get to see that original cast in the original staging do that, which I think, again, Lin and the producers of Hamilton, Jeffrey Seller and everybody were following. They grew up on those video captures and that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to, again, follow that tradition.
What's your take on musicians who decide they too want something on Broadway? And I mean people like Elton John, Billy Elliot, Lion King, Sting, The Last Ship. The great part about doing what I do is when that show comes to Chicago, I get to interview those people. When would I ever get to talk to Sting or Elton John? Then
right.
That's
right.
When I got to talk to them. But people like that, Cyndi Lauper, Kinky Boots. What is it, do you think, that takes somebody who has known the world of music and entices them to go, I'm going to Broadway?
Okay. So as a great example of that, we did the world premiere of the musical Memphis, which went on to win the Tony Award for Best Musical at the Fifth Avenue Theater when I was running that theater. And David Bryan, who was one of the original members of Bon Jovi, the main songwriter of Bon Jovi, loved this opportunity to write songs in all these different modes and different styles and for different voices, different characters, rather than just for the persona of Bon Jovi, of the band. And I think that's been true for so many other songwriters. Dolly Parton, I think, expressed similar things when she wrote the music for 9 to 5.
I'll add one to you. David Foster. I interviewed him when he was in Chicago doing Boop. And that, too, was a chance of writing genres he had just not touched before.
Exactly. And especially for people with long careers and a lot of experience writing songs, they're looking for new adventures and new things to do. I think the results are a mixed bag of things, but they can be, of course, they're great songwriters in their own world. If they can figure out how to then use that gift to tell the story of a Broadway musical, it's really amazing.
You have a chapter in the book in the 1990s and early 2000s, and just a little list of those, because I love these shows. Ragtime, La Cage aux Folles, Hairspray, Mama, and you got to throw Mark Shame and Scott Whitman in there as a songwriting team making a difference today.
Absolutely.
Full Monty, producers, Kinky Boots, you can go on. My point is, what is it? We dust Wicked in there. It's all in that era. What is it in the modern era that works for making a successful musical today? And I just want to kick it off by saying sometimes it seems to be a retelling of history played with, like Ragtime does. Sometimes it's the challenge of social issues, a La Cage aux Folles, a Kinky Boots. I mean, what is it today if somebody's writing a musical, they say, here's how I write a hit because here's what I'm going to play to?
I mean, of course, no one can know what's going to be a hit. That's one of the hardest things about a Broadway musical is the worst ideas often end up being the best shows. And the most surefire kind of ideas, what seem surefire on paper, just end up falling flat because maybe they're too obvious. I guess my question then would be based on the book and the shifts. What is the next era of the Broadway musical?
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, what will that be? I think nobody would have predicted what happened with Oklahoma was going to happen in 1941, just a year beforehand.
And one saw Hamilton coming.
No one saw Hamilton coming. And no one saw what really happens with Hamilton and Hairspray and all those shows you talk about. What happens at the beginning of the 21st century was something that really was unexpected. The traditional form of the musical, both musical comedies and musical plays, came back after all the experimentation and the mega musicals of the 70s and the 80s, which were sort of rejecting these sort of traditional form. That came back in spades with these shows, again, with Hairspray, which is, you know, not a different in form than, you know, Damn Yankees, except that it uses contemporary music as part of its story. And it's coming from a contemporary sensibility. But we really sort of went back to a lot of traditional ways to do musicals. So I think what will be next, because it usually goes, it's a pendulum, will be more some kind of experimental take, some kind of anti-traditional take on the musical will be what comes next. But we haven't seen that yet.
And here's a question you can't answer either. Do you expect that to come from the next Lin-Manuel Miranda project? Or do you expect that to be, oh no, there's probably somebody out there we're not talking about right now who's going to blow us away?
Probably most likely the latter, but I wouldn't count Lin-Manuel Miranda out because, like Sondheim, who started in a traditional mode with writing shows in the golden age of Broadway, he then got, I think, bored with that and felt like there was nowhere else to take that for him. They had done the most perfect musicals there could be, West Side Story and Gypsy. So and he didn't like to repeat himself. So then he delved into and, you know, partnered with other people to find new ways to tell the story. And gave us more to see, very famously, as they say in Sunday in the Park with George. And I think Lin-Manuel Miranda may very well do that as well, because he's, number one, so smart, and he's still very young. I think he'll want to find something new to do rather than repeat what he did before.
You just made a reference to something I did want to ask you, and that is, you said, you know, when people sort of know that Gypsy and West Side Story are the perfect musicals, both have Sondheim in common. But that being said, it does seem to be somebody, if they want you to think they know about theater, they will make a reference to Gypsy as the perfect musical. What makes a perfect? Why is it perfect? Why is West Side Story perfect? And isn't there something else we could look at and say, well, that's pretty perfect too?
Yeah, certainly Fiddler on the Roof, I would put in that category. There are a lot of shows from that end of the last decade of the Golden Age, or Gypsy's a little before that. But and I think the writers, the creators of the shows, Hal Prince, who was produced most of those shows, knew at the time they were reaching the peak of this particular kind of form. They had taken the Rodgers and Hammerstein formula as far as you could take it. It was as if the goal was integration, if meaning that the music and the lyrics and the dancing and every aspect of it was all serving the same story and just perfectly leading from one thing to the next. They had done that about as perfectly as you possibly could. Fiddler being a great example, and how Prince produced Fiddler on the Roof. So I do think they felt like, well, we got to move on. What's next? What will be the next thing? And how do we do it? And they started by breaking it down by, you know, trying to tell non-traditional stories in non-traditional ways.
And what is it about somebody like Sondheim who seems to, you kind of have to have an affinity for him. I mean, there are people who maybe don't like, they're not Sondheim fans and they make news by saying such a thing. But I also think some of these people, and maybe it has to do with their passing, but you know, you might have 10 years ago, some people could say, you know, I'm not a Sondheim fan. But then when Sondheim dies, all of a sudden you look at him and you go, wait a minute, this guy was revolutionary in the musical industry.
Yeah.
Is it just a matter of a historical perspective back?
I think partly it's the shock of somebody being gone. And of course, it puts a lot of focus on them. But it is, what you're saying is really interesting, because I ran a theater company for 20 years. And there was a time when you couldn't count on selling tickets to a Sondheim show. Very, you know, it was going to be, you wanted to do it, but you had to lower your expectations. And now those are the shows.
By the way, I'm saying Merrily We Roll Along, when it first opened, and you write about this, was a bomb. And now you couldn't get tickets to it with Daniel Radcliffe.
Absolutely. But even just in terms of, you know, what, when theater companies are scheduling their seasons, now you look at Sondheim as a cash cow in a way that you never would before. So partly, I think the world caught up with Sondheim. He was ahead of the time. He was ahead of the form. He did things that it took a while. He was a, you know, an acquired taste in many ways. And I think we, the world has acquired that taste in the process.
I will say, for me, a favorite genre, I mean, I'm probably in the last 20, 30 years. Yes, I can point to something in the past and say, I like West Side Story and go, yeah, that was really good. But I probably live in the world of the Kinky Boots and the Wicked and Hairspray. And maybe because I can interact with a lot of those people, with Stephen Schwartz or Mark Shaman, you know, sure. And maybe that adds to it. But that being said, and by the way, if you told me, oh, I've got a Rodgers and Hammerstein thing coming on, probably not going to watch that. And yet Hammerstein gives Sondheim his start. So what do I know? What right. is your, do you have a favorite genre? You know it from day one of your Broadway theater. Do you look and you say, no, I appreciate it all. I don't care what's on. I'm going to watch it.
I have to say, I love things about all of the eras. There are, and I, because I, how could you not love Gershwin music, Gershwin's lyrics, Cole Porter's lyrics? Noel Coward is one of my favorite artists of all time. For some reason, from the time I was 12 years old, I was obsessed with Noel Coward, which is very weird. But so I do have this great affinity for the Silver Age, for that era. But of course, emotionally, the impact of those shows from the Golden Age, My Fair Lady, things like that, which, like you, they may not be my go-to shows, but I can't help, but they are the greatest shows. They are by far among the greatest musicals ever written in terms of form and craft. But
was it, by the way, that Lerner and Lowe, and I don't mean to interrupt, I go back to where you were, but Lerner and Lowe, Rodgers and Hammerstein, I think, because you just sort of said it, they were, when they were created, you were going to see a spectacle. You don't necessarily, today you go to, you know, Next to Normal and it's, you know, they got the house set up and the staircase, but the focus is not necessarily the set.
Right, right. Well, and it's, a lot of it is economics. I mean, and it was also what the expectation of the audience going in at that time is, they established a style of theater, and that's what people expected. And a lot of that happens then when we go to the modern era, where, I mean, think about, I write about that in the book. It's one of my favorite sections, where if you went back in time and you went to that 1 week in 1968 and you could see so many of the Golden Age shows, and you stay one more night and you see the opening night of Hair, and Hair is on a bare stage with scaffolding, introduced an entirely new style of doing theater, which drew from the avant-garde theater in Europe to a great extent. And so there, and then we've seen that style. Hamilton basically has the same set as Hair today. That style, that platform style of staging, is still very much with us, a non-realistic kind of way of putting shows on the stage, which is really exciting. Then we went back with the turn of the 21st century into a very traditional sort of musical comedy realism, is what I call it. Even Hairspray has a very sort of traditional set to it. Most of the musical comedies of the last decade or so are trying to put some sort of form of reality on the stage. Next to Normal is a great example of the opposite of that, where it is again a platform set and sort of exciting, unrealistic aspects of how you put the show on the stage. So I think we've had both of those all along, but yes, a lot of it is driven by economics. It's also why I think we have challenges in the theater today because Come From Away is a great example. And we were involved with the workshop of Come From Away at the Fifth Avenue Theater. What that show was able to do was give you the impact of a big Broadway musical with only 12 people on stage, which is really hard to do. Most shows that only have 12 people on stage, the audience doesn't really want to see, and you get down to four or five people, and it's just not what we want from a Broadway musical.
Yeah.
It's not the experience we want to see emotionally.
Unless, by the way, you can pull off a one-person show, and I'm thinking of shows I had the privilege of seeing: Leslie, Lena Horne, Lady and Her Music, Elaine Stritch. These sort of a star who could bring them in, just them on stage, but it was also a musical, different from, say, a Hal Holbrook as Mark Twain Tonight kind of a thing. We're not in that genre here, but right. I mean, there are certain people, very few of them, who could run forever on Broadway just because of who they are.
They were shows in themselves.
Yeah. Did you
They
ever
were
see Lady in
that.
Your Music? Did you ever see Lady in Your Music,
I
though?
did see Lena Horne on Broadway, yeah, do
Oh,
that. It's phenomenal.
it was just stunning. Okay, I have one last cleanup question. It's not the way to end the show, but I forgot to ask this earlier, this is when I got you. Shows like The Wiz that take a property like The Wizard of Oz, they turn that into a musical too, but it tends to be for kids. And then somebody gets the idea of going, we're going to appeal to a different audience. I mean, to everybody, but we're going to put a primarily African American cast. We're going to change the music. It's going to sound like The Wizard of Oz because we're going to do a song called The Wiz. It just won't be come, let's go see The Wiz. What is your view of that? Taking something and saying we're going to modify it in significant ways.
I mean, I love The Wiz. I actually saw the original production of The Wiz. I don't think any production afterwards has equaled that for me. And I think it was a revolutionary act, actually. It was Black artists reclaiming one of the fundamental stories of American culture and saying, we get to tell this story too. It's not very different than what Lin-Manuel Miranda did with Hamilton, which is say, we get to tell this story. We get to be part of this story. And in the book, I go back to the very beginning of the Broadway musical to George M. Cohan, who, and I compare it to Lin-Manuel Miranda 100 years later. George M. Cohan, for an Irish American immigrant, he was the son of immigrants, but to stand on stage in 1905 and sing, I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, was the real live nephew of my Uncle Sam, was a revolutionary act. It was a political statement to say, I'm just as American as everyone else. I get to tell this story and be this character as well. And
Especially
I
because he was an immigrant.
Totally. And he was an Irish Catholic, which was the bottom of the barrel. They were, and in fact, one thing I point to in the book is even as late as the 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan, when it has its resurgence, it's its big resurgence in the 20s, they are just as against Irish Catholics as they are Black Americans. It's the two things are equal in their view, equally, hateful as far as they're concerned. And that's something I try to help us get back into the time period in the book and experience try to see the world the way the world was seeing itself at the time, which is hard to do because now we have, we just had every political figure in American, politics is Catholic or was Catholic at a very recent time. We just don't perceive the prejudice that there was there against that. And I love that thread. And one of the things I try to do with the book is connect the dots from the beginning of this musical to today and back and forth all the way through. Because I do see it as this one continuum. It's a timeline, and we have a timeline in the middle of the book, but it's because the musical, each dot connects to the next, and I find that fascinating.
And I'm with you. And although my question wasn't the best to end on, your answer was. And so once again, I'm going to remind people, Broadway Nation, which is how immigrant, Jewish, queer, and Black artists invented the Broadway musical. For all the time we spent on this show covering specific shows, this is a must-watch. And you have been watching, so thank you to the viewers and listeners for checking this out. You definitely want to check out the book because if you love Broadway or know much about it, you're going to be getting one right online in about 5 seconds. David Armstrong, thank you for all your time. I'm sure I've abused your time today, I couldn't wait to do this. I enjoyed the book so much. I congratulate you on that. And we need to just talk again someday because you know what? There's new musicals taking the stage every day.
Thank you, Paul. I loved every second of it and would love to talk to you about every show you do or every show you're covering.
You've got it. All right. Thanks, everybody, for watching us here again on Paul List Behind the Curtain, and especially the bonus chat right here. It was worth it, wasn't it? We'll see you next week on Behind the Curtain. Thanks for joining us. Okay, there we have it.